Real families, real farms, real food. Welcome to Arizona Agriculture Connection with Maricopa County Farm Bureau. My name is Nicole Clements, Executive Director, and I'll be your host. Maricopa County Farm Bureau is the voice of agriculture in a community that thrives on the dichotomy of urban and rural agriculture operations. This podcast is a home for farmers, ranchers, food lovers, prospective agriculturalists, and those looking to connect the food on their plate with the farm that it came from. As we take an inside look at agriculture in Arizona, we will delve into topics like ag technology, policy, food preparation, and everything in between. You can find us on your favorite podcast platform with new episodes every Wednesday. Arizona Agriculture Connection is hosted by Maricopa County Farm Bureau and sponsored by Paloma Ready Mix and Materials, a proud supporter of agriculture and our communities. Be sure to subscribe and share your favorite episodes with your friends. For more interactions, follow us on social media, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn at Maricopa County FB. Now let's discover some Arizona agriculture. Welcome back, Arizona Aggies, to another edition of Arizona Agriculture Connection. And this week, I'm very excited to have my friend and board member, our Eastside Director, Harold Payne, with us today. So thanks, Harold, for being here.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
Perfect. So we're going to dive a little bit into what you do around Maricopa County here today. But I'd like to start out with a little bit of your background. How did you get started in agriculture? You know, did you grow up in it? What did that look like for you?
I grew up on a farm, on a family farm. My grandfather moved into this area in 1912, just 2 years before Arizona's a state. And they settled in the Gila Valley up near Duncan and Verdon, New Mexico. And my father was born in 1914. And I grew up on a farm where two of his brothers and his father well farmed together, had cotton and silage, corn and cattle and pigs and cotton. So I grew there. I grew up in that environment with next door to my grandparents and my aunt and uncle and multiple cousins. And then when I was 14, starting freshman year of high school, we moved to Thatcher, Arizona, and my dad became his own independent farming operation. He had livestock and he owned a feed store. So my high school years I spent working in the feed store and the livestock and operations and moving cattle, moving pigs. Then I left for 2 years to South America on a church mission and came back and went to Brigham Young University and got a degree in agronomy in 1974. And then I went to the U of A for another 2 years and graduated in 1976, which was exactly 50 years ago this year. And I went to work in 76 in Idaho as a county agent. And I worked there for a while. Then I worked for an ag consultant working the potatoes and the corn in Idaho. Then it got really cold and I didn't know you couldn't take a soil sample when this ground is frozen because you're also frozen. And so I came back and went to work for the University of Arizona on their research station at the Cotton Center in Phoenix and worked there for a year. And then I saw an opportunity in the ag consulting field and I hired with an engineering firm that specialized in agricultural development. And I worked with them for 10 years and then they were getting out of the ag consulting business, so I bought out that division and set it up in 1986 and have been there ever since. And this particular farm, I bid on a contract to do a crop suitability study for them. They got Fort McDowell Indian Reservation got a water settlement with SRP in 1993, but they didn't really have much of a farm. And they said, we want to develop a farm and utilize our water. So we did a study for them and determined that the crops that they grow today were the most suitable. It's a 2,000-acre farm. We take water straight from the Verde River in a canal. And so we planted 1,000 acres of pecan trees and 300 acres of citrus. And then there's about 500 acres of field crops, which is all alfalfa now. And so I stayed on for the next 30 years to manage this farm and do some other consulting also. And then a couple of years ago, I stepped back and turned it over to my partner, Darren, and he's general manager now. And I come in as needed and kind of support him. So that's where we are today.
That's such a great opportunity, I think, for you as well as the reservation. So, can you speak a little bit to how that relationship works and, how it has worked for the last 30 some odd years?
Yes, the Fort Modelia Yavapai Nation owns eight business enterprises, commercial enterprises. Of course, the big cow is the casino. They own a dude ranch across the river. They have two golf courses. They have a hotel. They have an RV park. They have a sand and gravel operation, and they have the farm. So these enterprises are designed to make money for the tribe, to generate revenue. So when I started with them, the farm was a department of the government, and I could see that was very cumbersome. If you needed equipment, you had to send a requisition, get it approved, and people were slow about getting things done. And as you know, in business, it's very dynamic. You need to be able to move quickly. If you have a good price on a crop, you can't be asking permission and a month later tell them, yeah, I'm good with it. And then they say, well, that opportunity went away. So I said, the farm needs to be independent completely. We need to have our own bank account. We'll give you a budget. We'll honor that budget. We'll provide you reports monthly so you know where it's at. And so I signed on as a contractor. So I was never really an employee. I worked as a contractor all these years. And it worked well because the tribe, they've generally said, we're not going to force people on you. We're not going to micromanage. You give us the plan and follow the plan, and we'll go from there. And so for all the years, it worked well. I gave them a really good project, and they treated me well. And so we're friends to this day, and I still try to support them wherever I can.
I think it's a great relationship when you think about agriculture, and agriculture is kind of the backbone of Arizona. It's what we were founded on and what we were built on. And we think about some of, the people that have been here for a long time. I think good for them to have a piece of that as well. So you said that we're growing pecans and citrus and alfalfa.
Alfalfa. Sometimes we grow barley when the price is high enough. We've grown grain sorghum in the past, but it all depends on something you can make a profit. We grew oat hay a few years ago, and that worked fairly well, but it has some logistical problems. I mean, they produce so many tons per acre that it's hard to harvest it and manage it in such a short period of time when it's ready. So, but basically, the field crops have kind of gone all to alfalfa because there's a good market for it. We sell locally. Almost all of our hay stays right around the farm in Scottsdale and Mesa and Payson, and we have hay brokers that are always interested in buying our alfalfa, so it doesn't really go very far from the farm. And so that crop has been the simplest logistically. It's a perennial crop, so you don't have to replant it every year. There's a ready market for it, and there's plenty of demand for the. We're not a very big farm. We have about 500 acres this year, but it's enough to keep our hay crew busy and also provide the feed that's needed by our neighbors and people that surround the farm.
How many cuttings are you getting a year?
This year there was 10, but actually we're still going on. We have hay that we just cut this week because the weather is so warm. I mean, it was 85 degrees yesterday in places, and it's unusual to harvest hay in January and even now in February. But part of the reason is some of the hay is getting old and it starts deteriorating in quality. So we're going to cut it now, and it'll be cow hay. But the first cutting of the year will be a nice cutting. So, but 9 to 10 cuttings a year is pretty common.
Which is, I think, crazy for some people to wrap their minds around if you're coming from like a two cutting region.
I had dinner the other night with the board members from an irrigation district in Alberta, Canada, and we were talking about that. They said, yeah, three cuttings for us is a really good year. We'll get two for sure, but that third one, we're down into September and October, and if it freezes early, we lose the third cutting. And then they're looking at us like we cut every 30 days all the way until the weather cools off. So it's quite a difference. Arizona, as you know, has the highest yields in the nation as far as alfalfa because our season is so long. And if you have adequate water, the alfalfa really, really produces a lot of tonnage.
Yeah. And so switching over to like the citrus and the pecan crop, how many times a year are you harvesting those?
There one time, we have five varieties of citrus. We have tangerines, tangelos, lemons, navel oranges, and real red grapefruit. But most of the acreage are lemons. And so we are a member of the Senkes Co-op, which, as you know, is farms in Yuma and all the way into California are make up the Senkes. So we ship all of our lemons to Mission Citrus in Yuma. So we have about a truck every single day goes to Yuma, and the crews are harvesting right now. The lemons, we pick them twice because not all the fruit is ready at the same time, but the navels are ongoing as orders come in. We pick the navels and the grapefruit the same way. Those two are sold locally. The rest all go over to Mission Citrus in Yuma, and it goes in nationwide and through their system.
I was in Yuma recently, kind of exploring some agriculture down there, but one of the citrus growers there had mentioned that because the U.S. is now importing a lot of the citrus, that the market has really dropped and the demand has dropped for U.S. citrus. Is that something that you guys have seen here?
We definitely have seen it. The price has gotten real soft the last 2 or 3 years especially. And one of the reasons is transportation costs have gotten so high that people in a lot of the citrus that comes in the U.S. comes through New Jersey in that area. And they figured out it's cheaper to bring stuff in from Brazil and Argentina than it is to ship it from Yuma to New York. So we have competition from foreign markets. And then, you know, President Trump, bless his heart, has not helped us very much with tariffs because he's opened up those markets more for outside people, and that's put pressure on us. So yeah, the lemon market has gotten much more difficult to market into. We still sell, but we're not selling at the price that we were a number of years ago. The same thing is true with the pecans. You know, about 10 years ago, we were selling about a third of the U.S. crop to China. And they like our quality. They like our product. And they would pay a premium price for it. But then when the tariffs came in, all of a sudden they couldn't afford U.S. pecans. So they went to South Africa and other regions of the world for their pecan needs. And we've never fully recovered from that, because when you lose a third of your market to the export, that drops the price, obviously, because now the local market reflects the lack of demand from other countries.
Yeah. So when you think about that with permanent crops like citrus and pecans, how do you pivot on something like, you know, if you're growing wheat and the market drops, well, that, you know, you get through one season and you can adjust. But how do you adjust with a permanent crop like that?
Well, it takes a long time and you have to have a really good reason to do it. For example, we have Fairchild tangerines and they have seeds in them. And so for all these years, we've been able to sell them to Sunkist and they would market them to like Trader Joe's and people. And then a few years ago, they came to us and said, the California cuties and the halos have displaced seeded tangerines. So now we have no market for it. So we've been taking those trees out. Right now, we take that water and move it into increase our alfalfa acreage because we don't have a tree crop that we can budget that would make money by the time you clear the tangerines, replant, and wait another 4 or 5 years for production. So right now, we've just reduced the acreage slightly. The other trees, we basically farm as efficient as we can. We cut costs wherever we can. We make the best yield that we can and hope for the best, because a pecan tree, you know, lasts over 100 years. So you're really not going to take those out. They're still profitable. The price is not as good as it was, but it's still a really good crop for us. And we have ready markets for it. Our pecans go, we ship them to Bowie, Arizona to be processed and cleaned. And then they sell them to a shelling plant in El Paso, Texas. And so the market's still there. The market this year is better than it has been for several years. And so we're optimistic that our major crop, pecans, are going to continue to be profitable.
And you said some of that crop stays local. Can you speak to that a little bit about where is that? If somebody wanted to come and find some of your crops in Arizona, where would they go to find those?
Okay. Some of the pecans are sold retail through the local gas station here on the reservation, but almost all of them go into the processing by South Georgia Pecan. But our citrus, all of the navels are sold to either B&B Citrus or Freeman or the Orange Patch, Superstition Ranch Market. Those people buy that. And then the same with what tangerines we have left and the grapefruit. They're sold locally. So if you went to any of the local fruit markets, we do supply quite a number of them. And we have peddlers and people that, you know, come and buy our fruit and then they'll resell it to some outlet that they have.
Okay. Good to know. So when we think about kind of transitioning some of those crops, are you at that point doing a reanalysis of everything you've got and what that looks like and what you could potentially put in the future?
We have done that analysis. There's an olive enterprise in Arizona that they would like us to plant olives, and because they have to buy oil from Chile and Spain and other places. They don't have enough oil with their small operation, and so they would like us to do that. But the economics of it are not very favorable, because the Yavapai Nation is not real risk tolerant. In other words, if we were going to go into that, they would want to see an analysis that shows that it's a pretty good chance of it succeeding. And so there's a development period where you have to buy the trees, you have to grow them, and you have to get them into production. And then also at that point, you're pretty much dependent on just one buyer, because we can't ship olives to California anywhere else. They'd have to go locally. So there would have to be a really good, tight arrangement with who you're going to sell them to. And plus, you know, they have to be harvested with a machine that costs about $400,000. So we've looked at them, but right now we're just hanging on with what we got, and so far doing well.
There's so much that goes into farming in general, but kind of specific to what you guys are doing here, not only with the various crops that you have, but also with the relationships, like you said. So is that something that you think being a part of Farm Bureau, is that helpful for you in that aspect?
It is, because Farm Bureau brings people together with common interests, common goals. You provide information that's useful to farmers. And in particular, you're looking at the big picture, like the bills in the legislature, trends in agriculture and nationwide, and kind of help us look at how can we take advantage of an opportunity if it comes along. It provides information that's useful as you make long-term plans as well as your short-term plans. And there's some good discounts that come through Farm Bureau. And in my particular instance, it keeps me in contact with other people in my industry that many times you get quite isolated on a farm, because you do your own work and you go to town and might see somebody. But unless you go to association meetings or conferences, lots of times you don't have a whole lot of contact with farmers unless they're your neighbors or friends for some other reason. So it is a good way to stay up on what's happening in our particular industry.
I think that's what I've seen a lot being a part of Farm Bureau, is just the, not only the camaraderie, but the wealth and sharing of information, I think is pretty critical to, you know, what you guys are doing on a daily basis. And those who choose to be a little more engaged, like yourself, and serving on the board, is that, you know, if you think about maybe young people breaking into agriculture or maybe just getting their foot in the door, is that something that you think is maybe critical to success?
We do need the succession, the continuity to the next generation. And there are fewer and fewer of the next generation going into farming because, number one, our base has shrunk so much in Phoenix with the urbanization. And you think about getting into an operation where you need to tie up, you know, large acreages of land, which is very expensive. You need a component of machinery. You need to convince a bank that you're going to give you a good risk, even though you may not have farmed much before. Unless you're part of a family, a legacy type farm, it's pretty difficult for a young man to get in. I have four sons and I cured them all of farming. They've all worked here. And as they're sitting out there in the middle of the night listening to the coyotes and watching the water run, I think in their mind it's like, maybe I should go on to get an education. So they did. And so I'm literally the last generation of farming in my family, which started in farming back, you know, a century ago. I'm part of a large family. I have 41 first cousins on just the Payne side. And we had a reunion a number of years ago, and one of my older cousins organized it. And as we're all in this big room talking about our heritage and our family ancestry, he said, "We all started on the farm through our grandparents, and then one by one, you all moved out." He said, "How many of you are still farming? Stand up." I'm the only one. And I'm thinking, I didn't get the memo, you know. But it's been a good profession for me. I like it. I have the passion and the heart for it. And I've been able to find opportunities that have taken care of me and my family very well over the years and had good relationships. I try to remember to tell people whenever I can that agriculture is the only essential industry. We are we're the basis of what everything else works off of. So when COVID came in and they were talking about essential industries, we can't lock our door and walk away. We have trees that are living. They're like a child. They have to have nutrition and water and care constantly. So this operation will continue in perpetuity just because that's the nature of the way it is. And one other thing that I think Farm Bureau works hard on is getting our message to the public. We're so isolated from the general public. Most people have no idea how that food came into the grocery store. As a matter of fact, my wife was from California. She was in a Navy family. She had never seen a head of wheat when we got married. And I took her to the wheat field and said, "That's where the bread comes from." I said, "Yeah, you'd be amazed at how many things happen on the farm that people don't realize." And I tell my grandkids sometimes, when you're eating a cantaloupe, somebody 6 months ago tilled the soil, planted a seed, took a chance, borrowed money, went to find labor to get it harvested, trucked to get it to the grocery store, and today you're eating it. But it started 6 months ago, and that hamburger you're eating, that might have been 2 years, maybe 3 years ago that baby calf was born. So I said, somebody's doing all this work in the background, and we reap the benefit without really understanding how the system works. And so I think the message to get the public better educated about the farming system and how fragile it really is, you know, it's not guaranteed that these systems are going to work perfectly all along. And we're in a really current bind right now because input costs have gone up so high. I was talking to these farmers from Canada, and they said, "Our potato prices are the same price they were 15 years ago, but our tractors cost three times as much. Our labor has doubled." And they're saying, "We make good yields, but we're not getting the return that we did." And that's true with cotton, it's true with wheat, it's true with most crops, that it isn't the price that's the biggest constriction. It's the cost of the inputs, which keep going up. The fertilizer, the machinery, the labor, getting access to things on time makes it much more difficult. So we're in a difficult economic circumstance in general in agriculture.
I think that's hard to realize too as a consumer when you're going to the grocery store and your prices have increased and, you know, you see your grocery bill increasing. But on average, farmers only see about 15 cents of every dollar spent at the grocery store. And that hasn't changed as our input costs have risen and everything. So I think, you know, that's one thing to think about, especially when we see a lot of conversation in the media about the farm bill and different pieces of legislation like that, that maybe don't always have a positive light to them, but there is a reason for that. And, you know, like you were speaking to, agriculture is the backbone of our country. How do we support that the best we can, you know? So it's interesting. And you talk about all of your cousins, you know, growing up on the farm, right? And then they left. But now the average consumer is like five generations removed from the farm. So your cousins have an idea, right? Like, even though they're not in agriculture, they have an idea of how farming works and where their food comes from and so on. But if you think about five generations, like, that's a long time. And there's a lot of people that have never, like your wife, they've never seen a head of wheat or they've never seen a cow in person, which for us just seems unfathomable. But I think that's one of my favorite parts about Farm Bureau and about this job is that we can share these stories. And that's exactly what we're doing today. We're going to go, you know, see some harvest and see what that looks like just to kind of open the doors and share that story and help people understand where their food does come from.
I'll address your comment about the food prices. I was working with a Hispanic laborer yesterday and, you know, talking about where he's from. He was from Guatemala. And we talked about wages and inflation and, you know, wages have gone up. And he said, yes, but he said, Several years ago, I could take $30 and go to the grocery store and fill a cart. He said, today it takes me $100 to buy the same amount of groceries that I did. And it's like, that's the reality. Somebody, you know, who's working for minimum wage, that's basically took most of his profitability away from his personal life, where he has to pay more than twice as much for the same amount of groceries. And so that's a really tight pinch on somebody who, you know, if people that are making plenty of money, it's inconvenient and they might complain about it, but it's not almost life so critical it is to people, you know, who are struggling to get by on small amounts of money.
Yeah, absolutely. And kind of speaking to that too, so in my time in Yuma for the past month, have seen and worked with a lot of the workforce there that's crossing the border every day. And some of them, you know, live in Arizona, but is that a big piece of your labor? Are you using H-2A, or what does that look like for you?
We've had a labor contractor who's provided labor for us, the same contractor for 25 years. And so he has a good group of people. We also have relationships with a hay contractor who his people cut hay in the summertime, and then the hay harvest is over in the fall. And so his drivers come and they operate our pecan equipment. So that's been a really good arrangement. That way they have work year-round between the hay operation and the pecan operation, citrus operation. So our labor situation is not as bad as it could be. Minimum wage keeps going up every year. And basically in the last 20 years, the minimum wage has doubled. And so when we use, you know, tens of thousands of hours of labor a year, that comes right off the bottom line. That's an additional cost, but you didn't get anything more for it. You just got the same amount of labor, but it costs you a lot more. So that's part of the input cost that we see continuing to climb and climb and climb.
So in your world, and, you know, in a perfect world, what would a good solution look like?
Well, one solution would be to put some kind of a constraint on the reasons that machinery costs are getting so high. And I don't know exactly what's all behind it, but, you know, part of it might have to do with relationships with other countries, labor unions. You know, I know the machinery dealers have high costs for their labor. And you look at some costs, like in the grocery stores, groceries go up, but they take a long time to come down. It's like up like a rocket and down like a feather. And you see that in some industries where they got a good price and they're going to hold on to it as long as they can until there's some reason to come down. And even though their costs may have come down and they're actually making more profit, they're very, very reluctant to reduce the price until the market requires it. So the input costs are probably not going to come down very quickly. It's like prices of houses go up, but they rarely come down. And we've seen that in the last 40, 50 years, that houses have tripled in price, but it's like there's no end to the demand for it. So the housing prices stay stable. And if interest rates drop, they might even go up more, because now people can afford houses more. So the ability to transport materials is difficult. Transportation costs are high. President Trump is trying to do some things. He made an announcement last week that he's going to do away with the diesel exhaust fluid requirements, which is a horrible impact on farming, because a lot of our equipment sits for several months. And because it's out of season, when you go to use it, the DEF is very corrosive. And now you have problems. You have machines that derate in the middle of the season. You can't get them running because of the DEF system. So those kind of things add a lot of cost and a lot of uncertainty to our industry. So I don't have a ready solution other than minimizing regulations wherever is possible will help control the cost that we have to pay for our inputs we use to produce crops.
Absolutely. And I know, you know, we work locally at the state level here to, you know, advocate for agriculture, and our government relations team at Arizona Farm Bureau, I think, does a good job of, you know, making sure that we have a voice at those conversations, and that we can at least use that education piece to share our story with the lawmakers and people who are actually voting on how we're going to continue operating as agriculturalists in Arizona. So I think just to Farm Bureau's benefit, that's a piece that I think is really important that we don't always maybe talk about. But the education's not just for consumers, it's for your lawmakers, it's for, everyone that's out there, and just having them understand how agriculture really works. Because again, if they've never seen it, they'll never know. It's not their fault. They don't know what they don't know, but I think it's part of our responsibility as agriculturalists to share that story and provide that education for those.
Well, we're in the middle of a very dynamic water situation in Arizona, because it's finally dawning on people that there is a limit how much water we have. And of course, agriculture has a big target on its back because it requires water to grow crops. You can't fix that. It is. So we spend a lot of money to become as efficient as we can. But from my observations and reading the news and things, I think there's a real crisis right around the corner. I read something from the Central Arizona Project about this deadline on the 14th of February, where the seven states have to come together. And if they don't, the federal government can take control of it. And they were talking about the implications that the water cuts are going to go to the cities next. The farm ag has already taken its full hit. I mean, we don't get CAP water, basically. Indian tribes and cities are next. And they said, if there's not a deal made, you will see some mandatory cutbacks in the city. And then I look at, like, Gilbert is raising water rates, and there's a lot of commotion about that. But 60% of the water goes to outside landscape in the municipal. And on average, I've read that that's the amount of water. More than half of it doesn't go into the house and is used. And it's like, I drove down through a subdivision this morning on the way in, and there's water in the gutters from the sprinklers that ran in the middle of the night. And it's like, those kind of calibrations can save a lot of water. And, the farm, we use a lot of water, but we also have become as efficient as we can. This farm, we have the state-of-the-art micro sprayers for all of the orchards. And their program, the farm manager here calibrates every day how much water, how long they're going to run. We have moisture sensors buried in every orchard to tell us how dry it is, and they're read every morning. So he gets those numbers and decides on the computer we can program which blocks come on, how long they go. All of our flood irrigated fields are laser leveled. They're dead flat like a pool table. And so we've gone about as far as we can with water conservation. But there's a lot in the cities that you can see people tighten up the management. We don't get a lot of rain, but you see sprinklers running when it's raining. You see sprinklers that where the design is not calibrated properly. You see water running off the hills in the landscape areas and go over. So there's a lot of opportunity for a lot of people to conserve water. And when it gets so expensive that it really hurts, then people start looking at, do I need this big patch of grass, or can I manage my water system better, or is my landscaper not paying attention, those kind of things. So my point is, I think there's a really tight crunch coming in the next 2 or 3 years in Arizona's water. You've seen that the legislature now has an ag to urban program, and how that's going to work and what impact will that have on farms that have the right location and ability to do that. We've always known that agriculture was water would be shifting to the cities over the years, just because that's how life works. But I think we're in a new era from what I see as far as the water issues in Arizona.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we're all waiting with bated breath on February 14th to see what's going to happen. So, hopefully we'll have some updates after then, and hopefully we can work something out. But you were speaking, so your water here on this farm comes from the Verde River?
We're part of Salt River Project. So when we need water, we give them a day's notice ahead of time. We call SRP and say, we want to pick up water tomorrow morning at 6 o'clock. So they'll release water from Bartlett Dam, and it takes about 6 hours to get down here. And then when we're going to shut off, we call them the day before and say, we want to cut back. But once we start in the springtime, pretty much taking water constantly, we'll move the order up or down according to what we need to irrigate. But basically there's water running nonstop for about 7 months because the trees and the alfalfa, there's a constant evapotranspiration going on. So we just move the water around to where it's needed.
I think that's such a good point and a good look at, we'll get to go out and take a look at some of that stuff, but such good information and insight on what farming actually looks like in Arizona, which, you know, is kind of the goal of this podcast. And we just want to share the story. So thanks again, everyone, for joining us this week on Arizona Agriculture Connection. And I want to thank Harold for your time and all of your knowledge and input. We really appreciate you joining us today and taking the time to share your story.
Glad to participate. Thank you.
Awesome. Catch you next week. Thank you for tuning in today. And remember, Farm Bureau has a place for you. Be sure to subscribe, leave a review, and share this episode with your friends on socials. You can also visit our website, MaricopaCountyFB.org, for more information and to submit a topic you want to learn about. Remember to tune in every Wednesday wherever you listen to podcasts. A huge thank you to Paloma Ready Mix and Materials for supporting our agriculture producers and this podcast. Maricopa County Farm Bureau, bringing you the stories of real families, real farms, and real food. I'm Nicole Clements, signing off. Catch you next week.